From the studios of KUSP Radio in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. My guest this week is Carl Reiner. He's an actor, a writer, a director, and just a short time ago, in 1935, he was bar mitzvah. He has a dandy new book called I Remember Me. Carl Reiner, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you for having me, and I love that you use the word dandy. There's only one other person in the world I know used that word, and it was Joe Stein, who wrote Fiddler on the Roof and Enter Laughing, the musical and the book, and he used the word dandy when he read my first book, Enter Laughing, and that's a good word. It makes me feel that I'm onto something.
Well, you've always been a dandy. And belated mazel tov on your bar mitzvah, by the way.
Thank you.
You know, most performers in comedy, they're either a comic or a straight man, but in your performing career, you were both, and very successfully.
Well, yes, I was more, actually, I started out as a straight actor, and I thought I was going to be a serious Broadway actor. As a young kid, I went summer theater for two seasons, did 24 plays, went on a Shakespearean repertory tour, and it wasn't until I got in the Army that I got up and started making jokes, because they don't let you put plays on in the Army. And so, you know, so I went to rec halls and got to be funny in the Army. And after I got home and got to be Sid Caesar's straight man on Show of Shows, and went to a college of funny people in that room, the writer's room, with Mel Brooks and Aaron Rubin and Neil Simon, Larry Gelbart. I became funnier every year.
Well, I'm sure you were funny before you got there.
No, I did. I was, no question, I had a sense of humor, but it honed it. Though I really was honed on that area, in that room.
Had you ever met Mel Brooks before you got into that room?
No, as a matter of fact, I never had. Didn't know who the man was. It was my first day on your Show of Shows. We're in the office of Max Liebman, who was the producer. And there was a guy standing there, Mel Brooks. I didn't know his name. It was my first day there, and Sid Caesar was his boss. He didn't work for the show. Sid used to give him $35 a week or something to give him jokes. He was like a pool tumbler, they called it, a guy who made fun. Anyway, he stood up. He was standing there, and he started to do a routine. He talked with this Middle European accent, and he played a Jewish pirate. He became a Jewish pirate who said, he says, you know what they're charging for sailcloth these days? $3.20 a yard. I can't afford to set sail. I can't afford to pillage and rape anymore. And that was the first words out of his mouth. And we, of course, for the next half hour, he just kept on, and we was roaring. The following day, it was a Sunday, and I saw We the People Speak. It was a Sunday program where they recreated the news, that actors say, last night in Russia, in Stalin's bedroom, there was a plumber working in the toilet, and he heard Stalin say, going to blow up the world Thursday. And so I said, hey, fellas, that'd be a good thing to do a satire on. And nobody bought it. So I was trying to prove how funny it was, and I turned to Mel, who was sitting on the couch next to me. I said, here's a man who was at the scene of the crucifixion 2,000 years ago. Isn't that true, sir? And all he said was, oh, boy. And from then on, for the next 10 years, I interviewed him. I said, you knew Jesus? He says, thin lad, right? He wore sandals. He always came into the store, had a candy store, never bought anything, always asked for water. Came into 12 other guys. Anyway, that was the beginning of it. And as I said, to amuse ourselves, or to amuse whoever's around, I get up and ask him the 2,000-year-old man questions. And for 10 years, from 1950 to 1960, we did it at parties, command performance dinners at friends' houses. Get up, fellas, do that thing. And it was at one of these things. And now we had, remember, it's 10 years. We figured it was only for our Jewish friends and our non-anti-Semitic and Gentile friends. That was good, because 5 years after the war, Hitler had decimated the Jews, and we didn't need anybody insulting the Jews anymore, especially ourselves. So, but what happened is that at this party, this party that was a guy named Joe Fields, who was a big Broadway producer, had a party at his house in Beverly Hills, and he invited Mel and I, and there we did our 2,000-year-old man. At the very end, three people came up to us. I remember as if it were yesterday. The first one was George Burns, who I hadn't met yet. I did direct him in Oh God, but here he was with the cigar in his mouth, and he says, "Is there a record on that? You put that on a record?" We said, "No, we have no record." He says, "Put it on a record or I'll steal it." and it was Edward G. Robinson, the famous actor, Broadway and motion picture. He said, "I want to play that man on Broadway. I want to play a 1,000-year-old man on Broadway. Write a play about the 1,000-year-old man." I said, "It's a 2,000-year-old man." "Doesn't matter. I can play any age." I remember him saying that. He actually said that. And it was Steve Martin who really made it possible. Now, Steve was a big talent of finding funny people and putting them on a show. And he wanted nothing more than just to present us, get us out to the world. So he said, "Fellas, I have a studio." He says, "At World Pacific Jazz, where I do my jazz albums." He said, "Why don't you take it over on a weekend?" He said, "It's Saturday night." He said, "Invite some people. Get up and wail." He says, "And whatever you do," he says, "if you don't like it, just burn it." And so we did. We got about a few hundred people, 200 people, and we wailed and did 2 hours worth and cut it down to 47 minutes, and it became the 2,000-year-old man. We weren't even sure that it was good yet. We said, "Who's going to accept the Jewish accent?" This, you know, it was. We were pretty worried about that. And when the album came out, I remember I was doing a movie at Universal. I had just written A Thrill of It All for Doris Day, and my next-door neighbor who had a bunker next door was Cary Grant. He came by one day. I said, "Cary, he listened to this. We made a funny album, I think." He came back the next day. He says, "Could only have a dozen." I said, "What are you going to do?" He said, "I'm taking it to England." I said, "You're going to bring this to England?" He said, "I speak English there." And so he came back, and he said, "She loved it." I said, "Who loved it?" He says, "The Queen and the Queen Mother."
Wow.
He's Buckingham Palace. "You played this at Buckingham Palace?" And then I said to Mel, I said, "If the biggest shicks in the world, the female Gentile, liked it, we're home free." And, you know, and it was a hit. It did become a hit very soon after.
Well, when I was a little lad, I stuttered terribly. I could hardly get a sentence out. And I also couldn't pronounce my R's, so I was a stutterwell. But I had your record, 2,000 Years, with Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks, and I had memorized it. I committed to memory, and I could recite that record without stuttering. That was my...
Wow. You know, that's the nicest thing. That's the best thing I've ever heard about the record doing for anybody. It did more for us, but it did a lot for you.
Yeah, no, it did a lot for me also. I love the record, and I love not only the 2,000-year-old man, but I also loved the coffee house and all those other routines on the record. And I know that I've heard you say that you never would tell Mel Brooks in advance what questions you would ask. But what about when you were doing the coffee house routine? Did you just make that up as you went along?
Oh, no, everything that we did was at parties. I remember a few times, this was a perfect example. I would make him anything I wanted to make him. I would make him I made him an artist once, and I remember saying, "Now we'll look at that. We're looking at an empty wall." I said, "What? Describe that piece of fine art up there." I said, "Is that an abstract piece of art?" He says, "No, that's an air conditioned register." Oh, I said, "No, below that, you know." But he fooled me like that many times. But what I remember once, we were in Fire Island, and this fellow, Steve Elliott, had a professional recording studio, and he had a recording in Fire Island. He had a recording studio, and we made a very professional amateur tape there. And I remember while we're doing this tape, a guy walks in. And it's this guy's uncle, cousin. He was a submarine captain. He had just come back from being in a submarine maneuver. And I said, I immediately said, "I made Mel a submarine captain." I said, "Sir, I understand that you are captain of submarine." And he became a submarine captain. I'll never forget this. I said, "Is it true, sir?" And he didn't know what's coming. That, like in the rest of the Navy, if there's trouble aboard the boat, when you're down there, the submarine captain stays down. He's no. When you're already down there, we go up. They come down. We go up. Anyway, he immediately found the fun in anything I asked him. And the thing is that what made it so funny is that when we were asked once to go to, we got a paying gig to go to, I write about this, in San Francisco at the Cow Palace, two performances at 8 and 10. They paid us an awful lot of money, and we were going to do selections from our record, because we had to make sure that they got something for their money. But we couldn't stay with that. I must ask Mel questions that he doesn't know he's going to get, because he's twice as funny when he doesn't know what. When I ask him a question of something he's done before, it's more leaden. He's looking for it, and it's never as funny as he does it the first time. So I was always giving him questions he didn't know were coming. And I'll never forget going up there. He was aware that I was going to do that. And he says, he was complaining. He said, I'm never going to do this again. He said, you're not going to talk me into this again. No, sir. He was so upset. And I realized what it was. I knew he was going to score big, because whatever I threw up at him, he knocked down. He really did well. But he didn't know he was going to come up with an answer to a question he heard for the first time. So he was less sanguine about it than I was. Anyway, we killed them at two shows, all the prepared stuff that we did from the record, most of it new stuff. And when we came down, we're riding in a car going to the limo, a limo to the airport. I said, Mel, he's not talking. I said, Mel, how much money would you have taken knowing the kind of reaction you would have gotten? And he said, $14. That bleach, he would have said, no, I'll do it for nothing, but $14 is funnier.
Yeah. It's a funnier number, 14.
Yeah.
Well, you once, when you were on the Sid Caesar show, you once were struggling to find the funniest number.
Oh, yeah, that's there was this Imogene Coca was going to break the bank at Monte Carlo, and she was going to place it on one number and keep winning until the bank was broken. That was a sketch. And we said, well, we got to have a funny number. Everything in the sketch has to be funny. The actors have to be funny. The words have to be funny. And the numbers have to be funny. So this is absolutely true. All these great writers, these wonderful writers, paid a lot of money. They're all suggesting numbers. 41, 16, 69, which is natural to somebody to say. Can't say that. It's, you know, it's,
yeah, that's right.
Anyway, 21, how about 51? Anyway, it went on for almost an hour. and every number that was tried was said, Imogene Coca would try it. And we said, no, it's not working. And then somebody said, and we don't know who said it, said 32. And said, say it, Imogene. And she said, 32. And for some reason, we all laughed. And 32 became the number. And just what we did in the office, when the audiences heard 32, they laughed too.
Who knew that there was a number funnier than another number?
Yes.
Well, you know, do you think your background as a legitimate actor served you well as a straight man? I think a straight man has to be a good actor to be.
Oh, there's no question about it. A straight man is a guy who makes believe he doesn't know that what is funny. You know, he has to. He's what the audience is. He works for the audience. He asks the funny man what they would want to hear him ask, what they would ask if they were up there.
We're talking to Carl Reiner, and his new book is called I Remember Me. In fact, we're talking to me because he's the author of I Remember Me. You know, I've often heard that the great Al Jolson, who was the world's greatest entertainer, according to Al Jolson, was kind of an asshole. But now your book, I Remember Me, also tells me that his rival, his arch rival, George Jessel, was also possibly an asshole.
Well, he was not anywhere near as big an asshole as Jolson. Won the prize hands down.
Oh yeah.
No, but Jessel, first play I was ever in after the war was a thing called Call Me Mister. Call Me Mister was a musical variety, a musical review, and I played it all over the country. In Chicago for 6 months, and Boston for 3 months, and we came out to the West Coast to play it at the Biltmore Theater, which no longer exists. And at the opening night, it was a very big opening. And as I'm going to the, I went to, oh, the following day, I go to my agent's office, And I'm walking to the parking lot to get my car after visiting my agent, and a call comes in. Somebody says, they chase after me. They said, get to a radio quickly because there's somebody going to come on and review something you should hear. So I was in the parking lot of Shaq's, the office, and I said, can I use your radio? Tune it on to 790, whatever it was. And there it was, this guy, George Fisher, who was a reporter then, a TV reporter, I mean a radio reporter. He said, last night I saw a play at the Biltmore Theater starring a young actor, and he proceeded to give me a review that I sounded like Jesus Christ. I mean, it was the best review any human being could get. He not only said it, my name, he says, and I'll spell it for you. He spelled C-A-R-R-E-I. If Mr. Reiner is listening to this program, call George Jessel at 20th Century Fox. There's a big, fat contract waiting for you on his desk at this moment. Now, George Jessel, who was a comedian and actor and a producer, was now the head of 20th Century Fox making movies, green-lighting big movies. And, of course, I went up there the next I called him immediately, and I never forgot his words. I said, this is Carl Reiner. You told me to call. He said, Carl Reiner? Oh, yes. He said, I don't want to make a big chimis. Chimis is a Jewish dish made on a Friday night. It takes a lot of work. It's potatoes and prunes in it, and it takes a lot of cooking. He said, I don't want to make a big chimis. Come over tomorrow, Monday, and he says, at 10 o'clock, and I'll come to my office. And I do it. I come to his office, 10 o'clock, sit there, wait for him to come out. I'm in the outer office with the secretary. He comes out once. He talks to the secretary, never looks at me. As he passes by, without looking at me, he squeezes my arm. He says, I'll see you in a minute, kid, and walks into the office. He comes out a second time and doesn't talk to me. And this time he has his hand raised. And as he walks back to his office, I wonder why his hand is raised. He was kissing the little mezuzah, which is the little prayer scroll that a Jew has on his door. He wanted me to notice that he was kissing the religious icon. Anyway, then he's come in my office. Well, in his office, I'm waiting for he's got a big fat contract he promised me. Well, for the next hour or 20-30 minutes, he shows me every picture on the wall that's inscribed to him from every president, every senator extant, plus every star that ever worked at the 20th Century Fox made to him. And then he sits me down. He gives me a picture of Lana Turner. He says, would you like this picture of Lana Turner? I said, I said, sure. And so he autographs Lana Turner's picture.
Oh, that was nice of him.
Yeah, and he puts two little crosses on her bosom, and he's noticed the lovely tits on her. I mean, that's the classy man that he was.
That's great.
Now I'm
man.
Sitting there, and he's taking calls from Europe, and I'm waiting for him to talk to me. And I'll never forget this. He gets a call, and he's about to talk to me, and Paris is calling. He says, oh, Paris, I'm doing a picture in Paris. He says, those idiots, they can't make a decision. They call me for every decision. And it was the director, and he said, he listened, and he said, sure, they're both worries. He said, they can't make a decision. I have to make it for them. He said, there were two endings to a movie. They want to know which ending to shoot. So I told him, do it both. They can't make a decision, and he couldn't either. And so, but he's proud of himself. He's proud of himself in berating them. Anyway, that's... Now, I'm sitting there waiting for him to say what I'm going to do. The phone rings again, and he picks it up, and he says, yes. Oh, wait a minute, he says. I've got an actor sitting in my office right across from me. He says, yes, he's perfect for the part. He'll knock shit out of it. Great actor. And he holds the phone, and he says, when does it shoot? He's okay. He says, I got a great part for you in a movie. He says, how long are you going to be here in Los Angeles? I said, well, I go to San Francisco tomorrow for 2 weeks. He says, I'll be in San Francisco for 2 weeks. Oh, I see. He's okay. Sorry, kid. He says, I need you right away. Maybe next time. And with that, he hangs up the phone and ushers me out of the office. And no contract, nothing.
Wait a minute. You got your picture of Lana Turner.
I got my picture. But what it was, I realized that after... what it was, he wanted to have George Fisher, the columnist, the radio columnist, say, Georgie Jessel found a great star and he's going to make a big fat contract. He wanted his name. He connected himself to a hit show downtown, found a star that he's going to make a star out of. Anyway, that was the story.
So now, you mentioned earlier, just out of comparison, that Steve Allen had offered his studio for you to record The 2,000-Year-Old Man. What did Steve Allen get out of that?
Nothing. He just got the pleasure that's what Steve was. Steve did that all the time. He was one of the dearest, sweetest men and cared more about getting comedy out to the world no matter who did it. No, he wanted nothing from us. He told us right away, he says, I'm not your partner. He says, I just want you guys to do this.
It's amazing, isn't it? I guess you run into both kinds. You run into all kinds in what you people in show business call show business.
Yes, I know.
in your new book, I Remember Me, it's full of stories about your family. And you mentioned that you have a nephew named Shapiro, which is my name. And your nephew teaches at CSUMB, and I teach at Monterey Peninsula College. It's right across the street from CSUMB. I could be your nephew.
I'll take you on as a pseudo-nephew.
I'll be an honorary nephew. And speaking of your family, your wonderful wife, you guys were married a long time. She's someone we all love. Not only was she a singer and an entertainer, but she is has one of the most famous quotes in the history of movies.
Yes, and Robbie Reiner, who was her firstborn, was making a movie called Harry and Sally in New York, and he called his mother. He said, Ma, I have a line. I want you to come to New York and say this line. And she said, wait a minute. She said, a million actors in New York were women act. He said, why don't you get one of them? He said, Ma, nobody can say it like you. And then she flew to New York, and that's that scene where they do a mock orgasm, faking an orgasm, and then Sal has the line, I'll have what she's having. And it became an iconic line. You know, the AFI and WABC decided to pick out the 10 greatest lines ever done in movies, and they culled it down to 5, and there it is. Like, there's, Rhett Butler with Clark Gable, Frankly, Madam, I Don't Give a Damn, Clint Eastwood, Make My Day, Marlon Brando, I Made Him an Offer He Can't Refuse, and Humphrey Bogart saying, this could be the start of something big. And Estelle Reiner is number 4, and I titled the chapter, Estelle Reiner Won Better Than Humphrey Bogart. Now, I also talk about the fact that Robbie wanted Estelle to do that because she had the ability to say funny things in short bursts, and she invented one that I mentioned in the book. When my daughter Annie was 16 years old, her brother Robbie suggested when she was wondering what to get for her 16th birthday present, he said, why don't you get what your friends got in Beverly Hills, a nose job, rhinoplasty. Everybody in Beverly Hills said, yeah, that little turned-up nose, they have any kind of a bump on it. And I said, wait a minute, Rob. Your mother is a bigger nose than Annie, and look at the handsome guy she got. And Estelle said, yes, it's not the size of your nose that counts. It's what's in it. and I was doing The Jerk with Steve Martin at the time, and I told him the line. And 10 years later, he calls her home, and he says, can I talk to Estelle? And I said, what do you want? He said, let me talk to her. And he put her on, and he said, remember that line you said? He said, can I use it? And there it is. He was doing Roxanne at the time, and he's playing Cyrano. And there's Cyrano saying, it is not the size of your nose that counts, it's what's in it. So Roxanne is turning in his grave.
I hope your wife got a writing credit on that.
Oh, she's getting credit right now. She passed away 4 or 5 years ago, but her talent lingers on in her paintings and her children and her albums. She's done 5 great jazz albums. She was an extraordinary woman.
You know, when you guys were first married, of course you know, but I wonder if our listeners know, when you were first married, you were working as a writer and a second banana on a comedy show, and that was in Manhattan, although you lived in New Rochelle. You commuted, and you had a little place, and you had to children, a wife. It sounds like a television series, I remember, when I was a kid.
Well, that's exactly how it became a television series. No, I was, after I did the show of shows, I was asked to do, you know, they were offering me situation comedies. The review format disappeared for a long time until Carol Burnett resurrected and brilliantly, and then SNL came about. But for many years, there were no more reviews, and I was offered situation comedies. I read a few, and they weren't very good. And my wife said, why don't you write one? And I never thought of writing a situation comedy. I never did it. But I was remembering that I was on, to this day, I remember exactly where I got the idea. I was on the East Side Drive, the Franklin Roosevelt Drive, and I asked myself the question. I recommend people talk to themselves. I said, if you're smart and you ask yourself a question, you may get a smart answer. I said, what piece of ground? I call myself Reiner. Reiner, what piece of ground do you stand on? Nobody else stands on. I said, well, live in New Rochelle with a wife, kids. I travel to New York every day and work at a variety show, a musical variety show. And I said, I'll write about that. I'll write about the home life of a guy who goes to town, talks about his wife and children when he's in the writer's office, and when he's home, he talks, when he's in the writer's room, he talks about his home. And so that's exactly it. I wrote a thing called Head of the Family, and then Peter Lawford was going to finance my doing a pilot, and I wrote 13 episodes to make sure I had a good Bible for whatever writers come after me. And I did the pilot. It was just okay. It was fair, with Barbara Britton and Morty Gunty and Sylvia Miles, wonderful actors, but it wasn't good enough. And I went on my way. I started writing movies for Universal, and I get a call one day. I had an agent who was very bothered with the fact that there were 13 episodes of a very good series potential lying fallow on his desk. So he called in Sheldon Leonard and Danny Thomas, who was producing shows then, and he said he gave them to Sheldon, read them, and he called me in, and I said, Sheldon, I said, I'm sorry, I did this, and I don't want to fail twice with the same material. And Sheldon said, and this is a pretty good impression, you won't fail because I'll get a better actor to play you. and he suggested Dick Van Dyke. I went to see him in Bye Bye Birdie, and there was maybe the most talented man that ever was in a situation comedy, ever. The man could do anything you ask of him.
How much was Alan Brady like Sid Caesar?
Not an iota. Sid Caesar was a pussycat. 9 years with Sid on Caesar's Hour and shows. Went to lunch every day for 9 years. And those were sometimes 39 weeks a year. And that character, when you're writing when you want a hero to be heroic, you get a really good villain. So we have to have the boss. The boss is always somebody who puts down his worker. So we needed that. And I made an amalgam of three guys. One was Milton Berle, who was very nasty to writers and everybody. He blew his whistle and shouted. He wasn't nasty to writers, but he was an impossible guy to work with. The nasty guy was Jackie Gleason, who had a show, and he never spoke to his writers. They wrote the sketches, and when they delivered them, he wouldn't talk to them. He had them slip them under the, or wouldn't open the hotel door. He'd slip them under the door. Second one, and then was a show on Broadway with Phil Silvers called Top Banana, which was an embodiment of these kind of terrible guys. Phil was the prototype of a bad, you know, boss comedian. And so I amalgamed those three, and he became Alan Brady, and I played that part.
And so well. And now, by the way, in that show, I think you were the first actor ever to kind of acknowledge that you wore a toupee.
Yeah, well, that came about because I when I got a toupee very early in my when it started to go, nobody knew I was wearing a toupee, but I couldn't not tell people. I always told people. When I was on the Carson show, he said, you look good tonight. I said, it's the toupee, it's not me. And everybody knew. As a matter of fact, on the show once, I took it off and put it on the desk. No, I said, when they asked me, you know, it was Frederick Murray who said he always wore his toupee, but he said he came to me at a big event once. I was wearing my toupee. He said, how do you decide when to wear it and when not to wear it? I says, well, when I wear a tuxedo and I want to feel dressed up and be a little handsomer, I wear a toupee. When I want to go about my business, I say, I don't want to be encumbered by having to put a thing on my head. So I always told people when they told me I look good, and I'll tell them it's the toupee.
Well, I hope you're wearing it today.
No, I haven't worn it in years.
The book is called I Remember Me, and the author is the legendary Carl Reiner, and he's been our guest. Carl Reiner, I want to thank you so much.
By the way, I have one little thing I have to tell you, because...
Go right ahead.
There's an embedded video in an iBook.
Yeah.
Music and photos, so that's available to people, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, with every chapter we see, enhanced chapters with me singing and dancing, seeing my kids as little kids, and there's an electronic book, an e-book for the Kindle.
So there's an e-book, an iBook, an audio book, and also, lastly,
Shapiro, you're talking it up. And I got a Shapiro.
That's right, you got a Shapiro there, too.
Right.
It was a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you
my
so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for your time.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can find us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, the legendary Carl Reiner. His latest book is called I Remember Me. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you soon.